Welcome to episode 300 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. When Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine on February 24th, 2022, Europe sourced 40% of its natural gas from Russia. The European Union responded with Repower EU, a proposal to end reliance on Russian fossil fuels before 2030 by sourcing new gas supplies, putting more emphasis on energy efficiency, and accelerating the shift to renewable energy. How has Europe fared in the 2 years since? A new Oxford Institute for Energy Studies paper, Burning the Bridge to Ostpolitik, stress-testing Europe's shift from Russian gas to renewables using a global energy model, examines the structural changes in Europe's energy landscape. I'll be speaking to its author, Senior Research Fellow Dr. Kong Cheong. Welcome to the interview, Kong.
Thank you so much for having me. I look forward.
Well, this is a fascinating story because I think it's fair to say that 2 years ago, Russia's invasion of Ukraine essentially was a step change in the energy transition. It created an enormous dislocation in global energy markets. It led to energy insecurity, changes in the way we view energy, the changes in the way governments think about energy security. And it was really a pivotal event, maybe even more so than we thought at the time. And of course, all eyes are on Europe. How has Europe, has it succeeded? I mean, it's had a couple of warm winters, which has really helped with its gas supplies. I see emails all the time updating us on, you know, where Europe is and its gas storage. Does it have enough gas? Is it filling up its gas storage fast enough? What's it doing with renewables? And so I was very curious to get your, when I got your paper, I wanted to talk to you about that. So maybe we could start with just an overview of your paper, please.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I think you're absolutely right in noting that, you know, since the, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine at the beginning of 2022, it's Europe has been since then at this sort of like a pivotal juncture, really, in terms of the its energy policy, its sort of like evolution and perspective on the energy security, but also most importantly on sustainability of the energy system, and in particular the pathway to decarbonization, and you know, the sort of like the trade-offs, both geopolitical but also economic trade-offs in terms of energy security, energy policy, and climate policy more generally. As you mentioned very rightly, that you know, we've been in Europe, we've been fairly lucky to have like two very mild consecutive winters. We also have been quite lucky because of the slowdown in the economic activities outside of Europe, and therefore necessitating a lower so like energy demand. So what we saw, as a result of the energy crisis and the cessation of almost two-thirds of the flows and of the Russian gas to Europe is in fact a coincidence of many of the factors, and therefore I was very curious as a researcher to understand what is the impact of a set of circumstances that could potentially bring Europe to a potential, you know, energy sort of crisis that we saw in 2022-23.
Is it fair to say that Europe has not stopped using Russian gas? You mentioned two-thirds, they've ended two-thirds of their consumption of Russian gas. But not all of it. There still is Russian gas getting into the European market. How much and where is it coming from? LNG, pipeline, how is it getting there?
So predominantly at the moment, it's coming from in the form of liquefied natural gas, which is shipped from the Siberian fields in Russia, to northwestern European markets. There's a continuation at the moment of the Russian gas flows through Ukraine, but this is under the question at the moment because, as we know, there is a contract between Russia and Ukraine to transit that gas flows to Europe, but that transit contract is expiring at the end of this year, and there are no signs of those sort of like negotiation on the continuation of the contract and transit through Ukraine. The third sort of like route through which Russia is all delivering Russian gas to Europe is through Turkey. So in combination, that is roughly the three sort of like routes through which Europe is still importing Russian gas.
I've always found it extraordinary that Vladimir Putin would go to war and is said, knowing full well that that war would have a profound effect on one of its biggest gas customers. You don't generally declare war on your customers. This is not a good customer retention strategy as a rule. And he must have felt extraordinarily cocky that he could get away with it. That he had them over the barrel, and there was nothing they can do. And to Europe's credit, I mean, it responded fairly robustly. You know, REPowerEU is essentially saying, okay, we're going to accelerate our energy transition strategies, our climate strategies, and you can stuff your natural gas. We're going to get off it. So, how successful has Europe been in the last 2 years in implementing REPowerEU?
Well, there have been some success stories around, rolling out of renewables. It has been, to me, it has been in continuation of the policies as that has been there even before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's a set of climate and environmental policies that have been enacted even before the war started in Ukraine, and we know that Europe has enacted in law the reaching net zero by 2050, for example, supporting massive scale out of the renewables in the form of wind and solar, so like renewable capacity across Europe. Having said that, there are still a lot of setbacks, and one of those setbacks that we found in the research paper that I've written is actually there are a lot of bottlenecks between European countries to move energy, to move gas and electricity in scenarios where we will face a prolonged winter, a very severe winter, for example, in combination with lower output from nuclear generation, for example, adding on top of that a potential complete cessation of Russian gas. We have highlighted in the research paper that unless the bottlenecks are alleviated, then the effectiveness of renewables and in particular the REPowerEU is going to be drastically diminished as a result of that.
I have an anecdote that illustrates this problem. Yesterday, I interviewed John Redfern, who is the CEO of Calgary-based Ever Technologies. They're an advanced geothermal company, and they have taken a variety of known technologies that come out of the Alberta oil sands, and they've adapted them into a closed-loop geothermal system. And their first commercial project, which they started last year, if I remember correctly, is south of Munich in Germany. And so they drill down, maybe, they use traditional drilling rigs, oil and gas drilling rigs. They drill down a kilometer or two into the earth where it's very hot. And they essentially drill two well bores, and they join up the pipe in the well bores to almost create like a radiator. And so when you put water in and then it gets hot, it conducts heat from the earth, gets hot, and then naturally expands, and you essentially create a siphon. And so you pour water, cold water in the top, you get hot water out the other side of the pipe. And it's amazing technology. And I think it really is, this is one of the technologies that has tremendous opportunity to scale up, and the fact that it's happening in Germany is very telling, because it, A, in the winter produces hot water for district heating. That's part of the commercial project. And in the summer, when you don't need as much heat for district heating, you can run that hot water through an organic Rankine cycle, I think it's an engine, and create electricity. So you don't need to plug it into the grid. You don't, the kind of infrastructure that you're talking about that tends to be a bottleneck, you get around it with this technology. You just literally drill holes wherever you need the heat. And for this project in Munich, apparently, they're drilling many, many holes and extracting the heat, and then they plug it into this district heating system. And at this point, it's the pro here's the problem. How do you scale it up in a short period of time? I mean, this is, you know, there's 350, 400 million people in Europe, 30 odd countries, and this, while this may be the ideal solution, it would solve many of their problems. Scaling it up by 2030 would be an enormous, I don't think it could be done. And this is an anecdotal evidence. It's a microcosm of Europe's problem. How do you make such a profound structural shift in such a short time? Is that a fair way to characterize this problem?
I absolutely agree, Markham. I think, this is not just in relation to the example that you mentioned, right? I mean, there are issues that in terms of scaling up of even the more traditional renewable source like wind and solar, it's a long wait time to get them connected to the infrastructure to deliver electricity and energy more generally where it is needed. And we again we I'm coming back to the issue of basically even making investment to connect European countries together more well interconnected so that energy is flowing where it is needed. And there are a lot of those sort of like problems, not just with the example that you just discussed, but with wind, solar, with the heat pumps as well. 2022 saw a record high rates of installations of renewables, because of course the fossil fuel prices were very high, but now we are coming to the fossil fuel prices are now coming sort of like gradually down to the level of to the pre-crisis level. Therefore, it's like weakens the economic signals to expand the low carbon energy solutions that we have that fulfills two objectives of the energy policy. One is, of course, to decarbonize. And secondly, as we decarbonize, we're reducing the dependence on the fossil fuels. All of this is very obvious. But there is a question of scaling up, as you mentioned. But the more importantly is the financeability of those projects, which are really dependent on the evolution of the fossil fuel prices. If fossil fuel prices are very high, then you have some of these projects are very much what we call in the money. They are profitable. But once the fossil price goes down because of the abundance of supply coming around, we are coming back to the question of public support for them. Public support, not just in terms of the scaling up, not just in terms of connection, getting permits and licensing of the sites to connect the wind farms and the solar farms, but also the basic questions of their economic viability under the environment of very, or potentially not very, but potentially lower energy prices.
There is a question, a geopolitical question here. And I'll come at this from the American side. There have been a number of speeches lately by one of my favorites is from Secretary U.S. Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo, and she talks about how in the first year of the COVID pandemic, so 2020, the Americans woke up to the fact that they were far more vulnerable to Chinese supply chains than they had imagined, And this has become an enormous geopolitical problem. And of course, we've seen the Biden administration in a variety of acts and legislation commit probably $1 trillion to $2 trillion over a decade to building the clean energy manufacturing capacity to lessen their vulnerability, their reliance upon Chinese supply chains. Well, the Europeans had to respond to that because they discovered the same thing. And we see now the EU is in a dispute with China about low-cost electric vehicles. And they're accusing the Chinese of dumping and basically of carbon leakage. You know, you're dumping your you're using coal at home to build these things, and then those the embedded emissions in your products then you send to our markets, and so that's a climate issue for us. And so there's this geopolitical tension that's layered onto this energy insecurity and the imperative of getting off Russian gas and implementing REPowerEU. How It just seems like a wicked problem for Europe to cope with. And so how are they managing the geopolitical dimensions of this issue?
Yeah, I think this is a very good sort of like point around, sort of like trying to shift from one dependency, right, the Russian dependency on sort of like another set of dependency, critical dependency on the sort of like raw materials coming from potentially regions where you don't have necessarily much of the influence of, which is a very, very fair point on this. But I mean, in terms of the question then is, what are the alternatives that Europe has in this relation? The paper that we wrote, try to highlight those sort of like critical trade-offs in terms of the both the economic trade-offs. So what are the trade partners that you're going to be potentially relying on as you try to do the to embark on the decarbonization, but also ensuring the energy security, right? We also asked another set of questions around the geopolitics. What if US LNG projects are not going to come in on time due to the pause at the moment, for example? What's the impacts of that going to be? Because the paper that points to the fact that Europe is going to rely very much on global LNG markets, global gas market, to deliver some of the security as it shifts away from Russian gas in the circumstances where it can be facing a prolonged winter with a very sort of like harsh and cold winter. That's another dimension. That's another dimension of the geopolitics, is to what extent we can rely, or Europe can rely, on its allies in, and in particular, in the sort of like US LNG sort of like projects, right? So those are sort of like alternatives needs to be explicitly considered and debated, right? And it's not just Russia, China, Middle East now has the tensions, right? I mean, to what extent Europe and the global markets can rely, and to what extent the impacts of the tensions between Iran and Israel at the moment, right? If potentially the question around the Strait of Hormuz, for example, where one fifth of the energy is of the global energy flows are coming out of. So those are really difficult set of questions that I think the politicians need to consider very explicitly in the debate around the cost effectiveness of decarbonizing, but ensuring energy security, particularly in Europe.
Yeah, when you look at it, Europe's position here, it's like a Rubik's cube, and while there is one way to solve it, there are many ways to fail to solve it. And it would be so easy. It's so easy to make the wrong choices and to arrive at 2030 not having achieved your goals. Now, one of the issues that has come up in the Canadian context is the role of government in solving this. And your paper, I think, argues that more renewable energy development is socially optimal, as you say, and more public support, it would be a good policy option. But in the I interviewed Seth Klein, who's a Canadian policy writer, who wrote a book, and he argued that Canada's response to this, same its version of this Rubik's Cube, should be like a World War II response, you know, where the government mobilizes the resources necessary to meet the challenge of the day, either uses public ownership to achieve those goals or directs industry to meet those goals, and takes a much more command and control kind of approach to this over a limited period of time to meet a crisis. And I'm wondering the extent to which that approach is either being debated in Europe, considered in Europe, or maybe is applicable to Europe. Your thoughts?
No, I think this is an interesting observation. What we argued in the paper, obviously, is that the incremental sort of like capacity of the renewables under the REPowerEU targets are socially optimal. Socially optimal in the sense that if those targets are met, then we have a much reduction in the wholesale energy prices, because renewables is mostly when the wind is blowing and sun is shining, it's mostly sort of like free. But on the other hand, it has a very sort of like high capital intensiveness in terms of the investment that is needed. Now, taking all of this together, the wholesale price reduction outweighs the capital expenditure. Therefore, we say that it's potentially socially optimal to support them, but given the evolution of the energy prices, the investment by themselves by the private sector might not be motivated in this regard. Therefore, there might be a call for public support. And the public support can be in many of the forms. It could be in the forms of the energy subsidies. And just as an example, the US Inflation Reduction Act, for example, gives potentially a very generous set of subsidies to scale up the production of energy and low carbon energy technologies. So we didn't go into detail what exactly in which form it should be. That is obviously because you also mentioned before that it's Europe is a it's a set of 30 countries. Some of them are very have a very diverse political landscape, social landscape, and therefore it's up to them how they wanted to decide on the support going forward for the scaling up of renewables. Some of that could be in the form of the state ownership of the investment. Some of that could be a set of long-term contracts, for example, or agreements between the public authority and the private entities who are building and can be owning or operating those facilities. So there are a variety of ways how the public support can be given to the low carbon energy technologies. And there's no sort of like single set of solutions that would be fit for purpose for all of the 30 countries in Europe. That's for sure. And it's going to be every individual country will have a set of own preferences and the sort of like the political tools to that. But what is important is that incremental addition of renewables is going to drastically reduce the energy bills.
Well, that's a good comment on which to wrap up our interview, Kong. And maybe to do that, I'll ask you to look out to 2030 over the next 5 or 6 years. And based on the trends we're seeing now, what do you expect at the end of the decade when Europe arrives there? And will it have achieved the REPowerEU goals? Is it likely to, based on current trends? Or is it likely to come up short? And I suppose we should, you know, is it likely to maybe overshoot those goals? What's your take on that?
Well, I wish we were overshooting the goals, but I'm quite pessimistic about that. Given the current trends on the rollout of the key solar energy technologies, it's sort of highly unlikely that we're going to be able to achieve or close to those sort of like targets of REPowerEU. I wish that could be true, that we would easily met those targets. But in the current, so like given the past trajectory of the rollout of renewable technologies, this is highly unlikely, unless what you mentioned before is that the policy and the politicians and the society in Europe mobilizes itself to the scale that you mentioned, like after the during the World War II, after that to rebuild the economies. That could, but those targets are really unprecedented in terms of the scale and the pace that we need, given where we are today and 2030 is just roughly 5.5 years from now. So yeah, that's the reality of where we are. And that's why we have this modeling paper where we show different trajectory of REPowerEU and the baseline scenario. Where we are is probably in the middle of there of those two, so like scenarios that we mentioned.
This is a valuable conversation to have, Kong, because the we talk about, the supply of energy, we talk about policy, all of that exists within a political context. And political narratives, the ability to, I was talking to a German customer or client of Energy Media's not that long ago, and she was saying that in Germany, the down at the consumer level, at the political level, the individual level, there just really isn't that much urgency. Not as much as that would maybe be appropriate given the conversation you and I are having. That would seem to suggest there should be a lot of urgency. She says there isn't that kind of urgency. And it's the politics of this that maybe can create a different set, a more urgent political culture where more action is required, and the country or the EU is mobilized to do more in a shorter period of time. But it appears at this point that it's not there. The politics are not there for that kind of an intervention. And so I think that's why your paper is very useful, because as you said, it's unlikely to reach REPowerEU goals. And that now, if that's the case, then Europe needs to look at that and go, well, how important is it for us to do that? If it's very important, then we have to change our politics and we have to do, go in a different direction. If not, then fine, we go in the direction we're going. So this has been a very interesting conversation. Thank you very much for this.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.